there was a whole history that was pretty obscure. And it was a very important part of the women's movement of the 60s, 70s, and 80s and after. And it was time to put some light on it.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Bhutan decriminalizes same-gender sex, Bolivia creates free unions for queer couples, and life behind the music at Olivia Records. Those stories and more this week because you found This Way Out.
I'm Melanie Keller.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending December 12th, 2020. The Kingdom of Bhutan is the latest country on the planet to decriminalize same-gender sex. The criminal code has punished sodomy or any other sexual conduct that is against the order of nature with up to a year in prison. According to Pink News, there have been no known prosecutions under those laws. A December 10th joint meeting of the Lower National Assembly and Upper National Council voted to repeal those provisions. None of the 63 members opposed and 6 abstained. The changes await the formal approval of Bhutan's King Jigme Khesar Namgyel Wangchuck. Finance Minister Namjay Cherring was among the government leaders to support the repeal. He said, "To keep up with the times." Bhutan's most invisible, fledgling LGBTQ rights movement lobbied for more than a year for passage of the sex law reform. Tashi Chenten of the queer advocacy group Rainbow Bhutan told Reuters that the bill being passed on Human Rights Day itself is a momentous day for everyone in Bhutan. Dwarfed by its neighbors China and India, the tiny, mostly Buddhist Himalayan nation is home to about 800,000 people.
Veteran gay activist Roy Tan is challenging Singapore's Section 377A again. That penal code provision criminalizes consensual adult same-gender sex. Offenders are punished with up to 2 years in prison. The 62-year-old retired doctor, also known as Tan Sang Kee, was part of an earlier challenge that focused on constitutional rights. The High Court rejected that effort, which is being challenged in the Court of Appeal. Tan's current petition to the High Court argues that enforcement of the statute has been rare and sometimes arbitrary. He claims that inconsistencies in enforcement of the law require its repeal, an approach, he says, has rarely been tried before. Well-known human rights activist M. Robbie is Tan's attorney. Robbie called the inconsistent enforcement of the Asian City State's law problematic. The government has already acknowledged that 377A should not be proactively enforced because it is deemed discriminatory. We know that they cannot go back. The only way is to repeal 377A completely. Tan says he expects the High Court to hear his new lawsuit in about 10 months, but he'll withdraw it if his prior challenge at the Court of Appeal is successful.
Bolivia is the latest member of the Organization of American States to give some form of legal recognition to same-gender couples. According to the news site opinion.com.bo, the December 9th move creates free unions for lesbian and gay couples. The action is intended to bring the country into compliance with a January 2018 ruling by the organization's judicial branch, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. That decision required all member nations that had not already done so to open civil marriage to same-gender couples. While it's not called marriage, free unions reportedly provide those couples with all the rights and privileges of civil marriage, and officials believe it satisfies the Inter-American Court ruling. The legal battle for equality was launched in October 2018 by business administrator David Victor Arequipa Perez and lawyer Guido Alvaro Montaño Duran. Now in their mid-40s, David and Guido have been together since 2008. A civic registry resolution named them the first same-gender couple to have the registration of the free union. Lawyers from the Rights in Action Collective celebrated the couple on Twitter, saying that it has been an honor to represent them. Hashtag love is love.
Marriage equality has come to yet another state in Mexico. The news site LaPoliticaOnline.com reported that Congress in the state of Tlaxcala approved a bill opening the civil institution to same-gender couples on December 8th. The vote was 16 in favor and 3 against. A two-hour debate preceded the vote to amend several articles of the civil code. The wording of the rationale for the reforms is rather unique. To guarantee equality and eradicate discrimination by recognizing marriage as the union between two people who are not necessarily male and female. Opposition lawmakers objected to the measure. They claimed that it contravened the essence of the core of society, the family. Apparently, the millions of queer families around the world escaped their radar, families with and without children. Even though a ruling by Mexico's highest court said that same-gender couples should be able to legally marry, the 31 states each had to figure out how to get there. The federal capital of Mexico City is its own jurisdiction and opened civil marriage to gay and lesbian couples first. 19 states have since followed that lead, either through legislation, judicial decisions, or by administrative actions.
Transgender people won two cases in U.S. federal courts this week. The Supreme Court refused to consider an appeal of lower court rulings that affirmed an Oregon school district's policy allowing trans students to use gender-appropriate campus facilities. The plaintiff parents argued that trans students should be forced to use facilities based on their assigned gender at birth. Their offensive reasoning was that other students reported embarrassment, humiliation, anxiety, intimidation, fear, apprehension, and stress produced by having to use these privacy facilities with a classmate of the opposite sex. The case was a reaction to what happened in Dallas, Oregon, a predominantly agricultural town about 15 miles west of Salem. Dallas high school student Elliot Yodar came out as trans in 2015 and complained that he was being forced to use the wrong bathrooms and locker rooms on campus. District officials responded by simply issuing a policy to allow trans students to use the facility in which they are most comfortable. The ACLU's Deputy Director for Trans Justice, Chase Strangio, applauded the high court's refusal to hear the appeal. He said that it had once again said that transgender youth are not a threat to other students. Similar lawsuits have failed in other parts of the country. Some of them cited freedom of religion. The Supreme Court declined to hear one appeal from Pennsylvania last year.
A U.S. federal judge ruled this week that the U.S. State Department should not have required a Nevada trans man to provide a doctor's note before it would issue a passport to him with a male gender marker. Oliver Bruce Morris simply wanted a second form of ID to complement his driver's license. The Nevada Department of Motor Vehicles identifies him as male, but the State Department demanded certification of his completed gender transition. Federal District Court Judge Gloria M. Navarro called the State Department's doctor's note requirement an unconstitutional violation of Morris's Fifth Amendment rights to equal protection. She admonished the department, writing that it has provided no explanation, let alone any evidence, of why it has an important interest in verifying a transgender passport applicant's gender identity. Navarro also noted that not all transgender persons receive or require physician treatment. When he filed the lawsuit in 2019, 25-year-old Morris told the Las Vegas Review-Journal that maybe my family will see it and have a better understanding and see how personal this all is for me. That I'm a person, that I'm a human, that I'm myself, that I'm Oliver.
Finally, two drag queen story time participants in Brisbane, Australia, are suing the former leader of the Australian Christian Lobby for defamation. Johnny Valkyrie performs as Queenie, and Dwayne Hill is Diamond at Storytime events and Diamond Goodrem in adult appearances. Both hold valid working with children clearances. A known anti-queer activist committed suicide following a small protest of a Storytime hosted by the Brisbane City Council Library. Former Australian Christian Lobby leader and leading national homophobe, Lyle Shelton, took advantage of the situation. Shelton called the popular Drag Queens Reading to Kids event the equivalent of harboring sexual predators and pedophiles. Shelton asked his followers, "Have we learned nothing from creeps like Harvey Weinstein, Jeffrey Epstein, and Prince Andrew?" In blog posts, Shelton claimed that the events are dangerous and that drag queens and what they represent are not for kids and they should not be provided a place in front of children in public libraries. Drag queens Valkyrie and Hill are charging in their lawsuit that Shelton's statements incite hatred towards, serious contempt for, or serious ridicule of the complainants. Valkyrie is also trans, and Shelton specifically claims that makes him especially dangerous. The drag duo is suing Shelton for $10,000 in damages and a public apology. Shelton claims that Drag Queen Storytime is an effort to indoctrinate children, and that the lawsuit is simply a demand for him to be gagged.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending December 12th, 2020. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is recording remotely during the COVID-19 emergency. It's written by Greg Gordon, edited by Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more.
And you can listen to News Wrap each week by subscribing to our This Way Out radio channel on YouTube. For This Way Out, I'm Melanie Keller. Stay healthy.
And I'm Michael LeBeau. Stay safe.
From the Furies Collective's publication of one of the world's first lesbian feminist newspapers to the explosion of women's media in the 70s and 80s, Ginny Z. Burson has been a visionary pioneer. Her new memoir about that historic era is called Olivia on the Record, a radical experiment in women's music. Producer Brian DeShazer arranged a conversation between Burson and Olivia Records official archivist Dr. Bonnie Morris. With more on the book and the times, here's This Way Out's Paula Thomas.
Before we hear from our esteemed guests, this is what Aunt Lute Books writes about Olivia Records. The burgeoning lesbian and feminist movements of the 70s and 80s created an impetus to form more independent and equitable social and cultural institutions, bookstores, publishers, health clinics, and more, to support the unprecedented surge in women's arts of all kinds. Olivia Records was at the forefront of these models, not only recording and distributing women's music, but also creating important new social spaces for previously isolated women and lesbians through concerts and festivals.
My family claims the right to know what's wrong with me. They say I'm not turning out the way the men meant to be. My mother's given up my marriage. Father's given up his son. The Holy One is way a woman loving women when it's said and done. Cause we're woman loving women. Sing it loud along.
Good morning, Ginny. It's an honor and a pleasure to be in conversation with you about your magnificent new book, Olivia on the Record. When did you decide that you wanted to write this important historical memoir?
I think it was sometime around 2015. I was invited to be on a panel with Judy Gron and Kalita Reed. Kalita was one of the founders of Diana Press, and Judy, of course, is a great poet and author and was one of the founders of the Oakland Women's Press Collective. And the three of us were on a panel at Mills College, creating a women's revolution in the 1970s. And it became clear to me after doing this panel, or while we were doing this panel, that two things. One was that there was really a lot of interest in what we had done in the 70s among young women and men. And two, that their idea of what happened, the women's movement and what women's liberation and what the lesbian feminist movements were about was a very limited view, that there was a whole history that was pretty obscure. And it was a very important part of the women's movement of the 70s, 60s, 70s, and 80s and after. And it was time to put some light on it.
And in trying to reconstruct much of the early years of Olivia and your own experience in the Furies Collective and the background of both the women's liberation movement and lesbian feminism, did you go back to journals you had kept at the time, scrapbooks, or did you begin with your most powerful memories and kind of spiral out from there?
I kept no journals, but I kept a lot of papers. But actually, the way I started writing was from my own memories, from the significant events that I felt put me on the path to starting Olivia. And then I went into my papers and you know, started talking to other women who, some of the other Olivia women and other women who were around Olivia at the time to fill in a lot of the blanks. And of course, there were a lot of blanks because, you know, this was 50, almost 50 years ago that we started it. So some memories were dim. But I did start, the very first piece that I wrote actually was how I how I got involved with Meg Christian. And that meeting and that relationship was really the foundation originally for Olivia Records. And that was very clear in my mind, that whole scene.
She was a big tough woman, the first to come along, that showed me being female meant you still could be strong. And though graduation meant that we had to part, she'll always be a player on the ball. My dress, and I etched it on my locker, and I carved it on my desk, and I painted big red hearts with her initials on my books, and I never knew till later why I got those funny looks. She was a big tough woman, the first to come along, that showed me being female but just still could be strong.
And I think one of the things you do very well is you reconstruct so many conversations, and that's an important part of making the history come alive. I think a lot of people aren't aware of how much of it plays out against the backdrop of activism in DC, and that the Furies House has been made a national historic landmark by, you know, the Park Service or the initiative that recognizes locations that are important to LGBT history. And it was the first that was made a historic site specific to lesbian lives. Did you have a specific vision for what you wanted the book to communicate?
I did. First, I really want there to be this part of the lesbian feminist movement that is really not well known, and that I want people to know about it. I want people to know what we did, because, you know, lesbians and radical lesbian feminists were in the forefront of a lot of change, and were in the forefront of creating all kinds of institutions that reflected our values and tried to serve our community. And what we did was important, and it is really overlooked. I wanted to look at what we did, both in the Furies, but mostly in Olivia, from the perspective of what it was like in the moment, but also I'm now, you know, 40 years older, and I've learned a lot, and I've done a lot, and I want to bring that consciousness to examine what we did and to look at where we succeeded and where we failed, and to try to pass on some information to this incredibly dynamic and powerful younger generation of really, honestly, mostly lesbians, and mostly lesbians of color, who are in the forefront of so much of what's political activism now.
It's very rarely, you know, brought out that the, you know, founders of Black Lives Matter are, you know, young Black lesbians, and that aspect is often buried. What would be called intersectionality often buries the lesbian identity. And I love that you're building a bridge across generations in that way.
What we were doing was trying to build the world that we wanted to live in.
Seems like there is no choice, only a pawn. It's so sad. You win and you lose, but still you choose. You know you do. It's a
You are listening to Bonnie Morris, PhD, author of The Feminist Revolution, and social justice activist author Jeannie Z. Burson about her book, Olivia on the Record, a radical experiment in women's music, published by Ant Loot Books. We'll be right back.
The very real issue is touch starvation.
What kind of country do we want to
be? I
want
to be in a parade.
I arrived here during the Cold War from the Soviet Union.
This is not going to end well.
Police sirens wailing. Get on the ground.
I campaigned for the presidency.
A lot of Polish activists fear that Poland is going into the same direction as Russia has been going.
Amy Coney Barrett.
Ready to say goodbye to this whirlwind year? Come join our 2020 TGIO party at thiswayout.org. Check out the queer highlights and lowlights, and look for the light at the end of this turbulent tunnel. A toast to our family of supporters at thiswayout.org.
Baby, have I got a ball gown to show you.
And now back to Jeannie and Bonnie.
I think when you mentioned just before building institutions and services, obviously, for those who are listening, we're talking about the development of Olivia Records, which was in so many ways a product in that albums were produced and there were also concerts and a performance culture that was developed. And I think in looking at the early years of Olivia, you write very well about the complicated economic and class aspects. How is this music going to reach women? Should artists be paid? Should the collective live collectively in terms of whatever money comes in? What does it cost to produce an album? What's the value of women's labor? Should there be a charge for tickets? Should there be sliding scale? And the agonizing hours of processing that went into all of that is part of what you just mentioned, trying to construct an economic system that was woman identified and that acknowledged the inequities in society.
That was a very important part of what we were doing. And, you know, beyond the music and beyond the performance culture and beyond the community building, what was a big part of the vision of Olivia was that we were going to create, we were going to have our own studio, we were going to have our own pressing plant. This was, of course, at a time when records were pressed into vinyl. We were going to have our own jacket fabrication plant. In other words, we were going to control all the means of production. And everybody that worked at Olivia was every woman who worked at Olivia, and that's what we saw, that's who we saw working there, was going to be well paid, treated well, have an opportunity to learn new skills, have an opportunity to become part of the decision making collective, and we called this feminism. And our expectation was that when women realized, oh, this is feminism, it's not what the media says feminism is, this is feminism. Feminism means having access and training and being respected and being paid well and working in a challenging, intellectually challenging and friendly environment. This is feminism? Okay, then I'm a feminist. And unfortunately, we didn't get there.
Bring up memory. It's for you, the love was for the
know, there was this explosion of creativity. There was this because that's what liberation, I mean, we were being liberated. We were in the process of liberating ourselves. And so not only were we creating, not only did we have all this energy for the record companies and the coffee houses and the bookstores and the presses and all the other things that we were creating, but we had tremendous sexual energy also that was free at last, really. And so, you know, there was a lot of sex and there were a lot of relationships and there was a lot of there were a lot of great times and there was a lot of unconsciousness about how to do this. Because we wanted to do everything differently than what we had been told was the proper way to do things.
I think that you did a tremendous job in constructing awareness of real people who were doing something extraordinary with, of course, normal human feelings, but a sense of obligation to go beyond the personal into the political.
You know, there were some hard things. All of it was hard and all of it was wonderful at the same time.
You can find Jenny's book, Olivia on the Record, A Radical Experiment in Women's Music, online at antlute.com. That's AUNTLUTE.com. We invite you to listen to the extended interview and our Olivia Records playlist at thiswayout.org. This was produced by Brian DeShazer and engineered by Rebecca Drapkin. I'm Paula Thomas for This Way Out.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Melanie Keller and Michael LeBeau, produced by Brian DeShazer, from Paula Thomas and Bonnie Morris, also produced by Brian DeShazer, and from Lucia Chappell. Thanks also to Rebecca Rapkin, Teresa Trault, Meg Christian, Chris Williamson, BBK Roche, and Gwen Avery performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This way, our thanks to Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, a bequest from Christopher David Trentum, and donors Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WRFC Rochester, New York, 3ECB Croydon, Victoria, Chiampa Radio, Tampa, Florida, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay safe, stay healthy, and stay tuned.